Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. With all of the difficulties in the Middle East as of late involving Christians and Muslims, the Crusades have been in the news once again. This week we explore one of the more unusual Crusades, a crusade that took place in the 13th century in France and that pitted Christians against Christians. And after that, Thomas Fleming will join us to discuss a fictional character, Philip Drew, and how Drew's ghost haunted Woodrow Wilson and may well be haunting the Bush administration. But first, Joey Skidmore takes us back to an important event that occurred this week in history.
This week in history, on August 21, 1831, Nat Turner led a violent slave revolt in Southampton County, Virginia. Turner, unlike most American slaves, was well-educated. He became a preacher within the slave community. He was trusted by his so-called owner and given considerable freedom to travel about the area on his own. When he was sold to a less liberal plantation owner, however, Turner became increasingly bitter and began to experience expressions of his longing for freedom and religious visions. Turner's plan was to rally hundreds of slaves to march on the town of Jerusalem, capture the county armory, and then to seek refuge in the dismal swamp. Putting the plan into action, Turner and seven of his followers killed his owner and family, and over the following 2 days, an additional 68 slaves joined the insurrection, adding another 60 slave owners and family members to the death toll. But resistance was swift and merciless. The state militia's force of 3,000 men soon crushed the rebellion. Turner was captured. He confessed, expressing no regret for his actions, and was executed, along with 16 of his fellow rebels, on November 11, 1831.
Turning to items of historical interest in the news, the uncovering of a cache of previously unknown historical documents provides evidence that Dred Scott may be the best-known slave to sue for his freedom in 1857, but that he had lots of company and many predecessors. Archivists at the Missouri State Archives have uncovered 283 freedom suits filed in St. Louis alone between 1806 and 1865. And archaeologists have unveiled the oldest shipwreck ever recovered in the Netherlands. The find is a well-preserved Roman military transport that sank along the banks of the Rhine 18 centuries ago. Although other ships have been found in what was then the sprawling Roman Empire, the flat-bottom barge is one of the few found north of the Alps. It was built about AD 180 as a paymaster and sank while heading upriver to deliver supplies to Roman camps along the Rhine. This is Talking History. Were the Cathars? What religious beliefs did they hold? And why were those beliefs so feared that the Church unleashed a crusade against them? Talking History's Eileen Dugan takes up the matter this week with her guest, Stephen O'Shea.
Modern scholarship has done much to dash the overly romanticized popular image of the Crusades. Once depicted as utterly pious causes conducted by valiant knights, we are now willing to question the mixed motives of popes and crusaders and to be horrified by the too frequent incidents of senseless slaughter. Of all the crusades, few are more disturbing or less understood than the Albigensian Crusade, a crusade that, beginning in 1209, took place not in the Holy Land, but in France. With us today to discuss the course and legacy of the Albigensian Crusade is Mr. Stephen O'Shea, author of The Perfect Heresy, The Revolutionary Life and Death of the Medieval Cathars. Hello, Mr. O'Shea.
Hello, Eileen.
Who were the Cathars, and why were they known as Albigensians?
Well, the Cathars were dualists. They were heretics. They were members of the most successful Christian heretical movement of the Middle Ages. They were known as the Albigensians because many of them were centered around the town of Albi in France. Now, the countryside around Albi is called, in French, the Albigeois, but in Latin it's Albigensian. So it was thought that the Cathars' biggest stronghold was around Albi, but in fact they were in the Languedoc, which is the southwestern France. They were in the Rhineland, and they were also in Italy. But they were strongest around Toulouse, Albi, and Carcassonne.
You mentioned that the Cathars were dualists. What does that mean?
The Cathars believed that there were two gods. One was good, one was evil. The evil god had created the world and everything in it. So the evil god, in fact, was the god of the Old Testament, God the Creator. The good god was someone beyond the evil god, the all-powerful god. So our life here on earth was hell. We were going through the hell of material existence before joining the good god. This is an old tradition of dualism. It's in classical times it was expounded by the Gnostics, who were also Christians and Jewish as well. There were Manichaeans, which is a pagan sect, which believed that there was a good and evil god. And then there were Christian sects throughout the first millennium of Christianity who also were dualists. It just so happened that the Cathars were dualists at a time when Western Europe was undergoing a religious reawakening in the 12th and 13th century, and they became very successful.
What about Catharism made the Catholic Church very nervous?
One was its success. Catharism had completely infected the nobility and the merchant classes of a very important province of Christendom, Languedoc. And secondly, Catharism said that the church itself was illegitimate. It said that the church was worshiping the wrong god. So the Cathars weren't reformers. There were a lot of reformers in the Middle Ages. The Cathars were saying, you are worshiping the creator god. Your churches, your vestments, your wealth is proof that you are evil. So, in fact, the Cathars were diametrically opposed to the church. So they were the enemies of the church. And the church, seeing its legitimacy questioned, naturally reacted against that.
The title of your book refers to the Cathars as the perfect heresy. Why so?
Well, the Cathars, the holy men and women of Catharism, were called the perfect in the sense that they were perfected heretics. They had gone through the stages of initiation. Now, what happened in the Cathar Creed, there were two classes of believers. There were the perfects, who were ascetic, who renounced sex, meat, all worldly goods. And it is thought that they would rejoin the good God at their death. The regular believers would be reincarnated time and time again until they were ready to become one of the perfect. The Cathars were also the perfect heresy because it was perhaps the most absolute heresy. If you think, when you give a normal Christian creed, I believe in God the Father, God the Son, God the Holy Spirit, usually a heretic will disagree somewhere in the second or third paragraph and say, wait a second, no, I don't agree with the church, I don't agree with that. The Cathars, you couldn't even get past the first phrase, I believe in God the Father. They'd say, no, sorry, that's not right. So that they were perfect heretics in the sense that they were the most absolute heretics. And, of course, they were perfect heretics without the article. I was going to call the book Perfect Heresy because the Cathars were perfect heresy to the powers that be of the Middle Ages, the church and the established feudal nobility.
Well, along with what was happening with the church at the time, you also bring into the story the political situation in the area at the time. What was the political situation in Languedoc?
Languedoc is interesting. It was a fractured feudalism, you could call it. There were several families that controlled large lands. In other words, there was the Saint-Gilles family of Toulouse, which formed the Counts of Toulouse. There was the Trencavel family of Carcassonne, which controlled central Languedoc. But at the time, there were also merchants in the growing towns. Toulouse was the third largest town in the Latin West in 1200, and they were wresting power away from the nobility. Now, you have to remember, Languedoc was not a part of France. Languedoc had its own language, which is a Provençal tongue. It was more allied to Aragon, to south of the Pyrenees, than it would be to Paris. There was competition. It was also a very wealthy area, trading throughout the Mediterranean world. One of the members of the family of the Saint-Gilles family was a king in the Crusader states on the other side of the Mediterranean. So there was intense competition between church merchants and these petty feudal nobles for wealth and influence in Languedoc, which, since there was no central authority, a heresy like Catharism could grow because there was no one to suppress it.
What was the general religious atmosphere of the early 13th century?
Well, it was exalted, one could say, because the 12th century had witnessed a spiritual renaissance in Europe. There had been the founding of the Cistercian order, which was a leaner, meaner version of the Cluniac and Benedictine monks. There were the Crusades, there were the Knights Hospital, there was the Knights Templar. There had been several heretical movements throughout the 12th century. With the reawakening of Europe, the growth of the towns, people were beginning to question established religion. They were looking for a faith that was more personal. So it was a very exalted time in Europe, and especially in southwestern France, rather in Languedoc, because they were a generation or two ahead in development than the rest of Europe.
And how had the Crusades been going lately?
Bad and ugly. Around the year 1200, several terrible things had happened from the church's point of view. One was Saladin, the great Kurdish leader, had retaken Jerusalem in 1187. So the whole point of the Crusades, the whole stated point of the Crusades when they launched them, was to take Jerusalem. Now they had lost it, 1187. Another crusade was organized to take it back, which was the famous Third Crusade with Richard the Lionhearted. He failed to take it back. Then, in 1204, there was a rather shocking crusade, the Fourth Crusade, in which the Christians from Western Europe sacked the Christian city of Constantinople, the greatest city of the Mediterranean. They were turned away from their objective, and out of frustration, they committed the greatest act of vandalism of the Middle Ages, sacking Constantinople, the head of the Byzantine Empire. The sack lasted 3 days, and they carted off tons of treasure, and it was a sack from which Constantinople never recovered. So the Crusades had been discredited to some people.
And thus far, we've been talking about Crusades in the Holy Land or in Constantinople. How did it come that a Crusade would be launched against people in the West?
Well, the Pope who was responsible for it, Pope Innocent III, he was probably the most powerful Pope of the Middle Ages, and he sort of had an all-directional idea of Crusades. He was launching a Crusade in Spain against the Moors. He had launched this Crusade to the Holy Land, and the idea of crusading was not foreign to him, and he saw that he believed that these heretics were not Christians. Heretics are not Christians, they're heretics. So therefore the idea of crusading was central to Innocent's worldview. And also he convinced the knights of France, of northern France, that they would be able to take over the rich country of Languedoc if they took part in this crusade. So there was a material bribe there.
And how was it apparent that this was going to be a new kind of crusade?
Because the scale of the crusaders didn't usually slaughter Christians or even slaughter Catholics. The first act of the crusade in 1209 was the wholesale slaughter of the city of Béziers, which contained about 20,000 people. It's assumed that perhaps one-tenth of them were Cathars. So the crusade almost genocidally just wiped out the entire town, including 19,000 Catholics. So this was obvious, the scale of the cruelty of Christian towards Christian would be unprecedented. And then afterwards, we may jump ahead to hunt down the survivors of this 20-year war of terror, the Inquisition was founded. Now, the Inquisition lived on, but the idea of a thought police that invaded, that completely invested an area to root out any dissident, that was also a result of the Albigensian Crusade.
You just said that they also killed in Béziers 19,000 Catholics. I mean, how could they justify doing that?
Well, there's an apocryphal story about it. The leader of the Crusade, when they first breached the walls, he was supposed to have been asked. He was a monk. He was supposed to have been asked how they could what the Crusaders should do, how they could distinguish from Cathar, between Cathar and Catholic, and he was supposed to have responded, "Kill them all. God will know his own." Now, whether he said that or not, I mean, the result is the same. Obviously, they basically each year of the Crusade, 1209, 1210, 1211, etc., they started with a signal act of brutality and terror. This was the first act of the Crusade, the first year, the first act of the Crusade. So when this monk, Arnold Amory, wrote back to Pope Innocent about killing 20,000 people, most of them Catholics, even Pope Innocent thought that the Crusade might be going a bit too far.
How completely were the Cathars wiped out in the end?
Almost entirely. The last holy man, the last perfect of Languedoc we know, was burned in 1321, and then a couple of generations afterwards, the Cathars of Italy, of northern Italy, were wiped out, where they were almost... They were more successful in Languedoc, I should say, the Catharism, but Italy, they remained a small sect until the end of the 14th century. So the Catharism was completely exterminated, and then in subsequent centuries, calumnied by Catholic historians as something that it wasn't. You know, there was all sorts of rumors about them being cat worshippers, about weird, very weird practices of the Cathars. It's only in the 19th and the 20th centuries, as it emerged, the Cathars, in fact, were this pacifist, tolerant, live-and-let-live medieval Christian religion.
We only have a few moments remaining, but why should we, in the 21st century, remember the Albigensian Crusade? I mean, what is its legacy?
Well, its legacy, for one thing, it's Catharism is the road not taken. It, as I said, it represented a form of Christianity and a form of social organization that was entirely different from the sort of monolithical, repressive model that unfortunately came to be in the 13th and 14th century. It's also instructive in modern day to see the church's reaction, the church's and the French king's reaction is sort of a template of the totalitarian state. And we can see the origins of that in the church's reaction to Catharism with the Inquisition. It's also interesting to think, if we like to think of what if history, what if France had not taken Languedoc, there would have been an entirely different country stretching from perhaps Nice all the way down to Barcelona, a different land, a different cultural entity. The history of Europe would have been changed. And finally, it's just a story that has been ignored or distorted for too long, and sort of we owe it to memory somewhat to remember the Cathars and not as romanticized heroes, which is the case among many Europeans of the counterculture. The Cathars have become many things, sort of proto-hippies, but we just should remember they were obviously a very brave, a very holy, and a very unfortunate group of people.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Mr. O'Shea.
You're welcome.
We have been talking with Mr. Stephen O'Shea, author of The Perfect Heresy, The Revolutionary Life and Death of the Medieval Cathars.
For our site of the week, we're visiting the Harry S. Truman Presidential Library in Independence, Missouri, where a diary kept by President Truman was recently discovered. With me to discuss it is Ray Gesselbrock, Truman Archivist and Coordinator of Academic Programs. Ray, first describe the diary for us. What's in it?
It's a diary book. It has the rather unusual title of Diary and Manual of the New York Real Estate Board Incorporated for 1947. The first part of the book, 160 pages, has all kinds of information about the Real Estate Board, members, committees, some advertisements, calendars. And then in the back of this book are, originally they were blank diary pages. And this book was given as a gift to President Truman by the president of the New York Real Estate Board, Christmas present, Christmas 1946. And President Truman apparently took a look at it and decided he would try to keep a regular diary. And he was someone who would write his thoughts down on usually loose pieces of paper. And we have a fair amount of that type of documentation in our holdings. But I believe that when he got this diary book, late 1946, he decided to try to keep a diary. So the first 8 days in January in this book all have diary entries in them. And then he begins to fall off because in his heart he was not a disciplined diarist. But he picked the book up. He apparently put it in his study in the Oval Room, in, second floor of the White House. And he would pick it up from time to time and write entries in the diary. By the end of the year, he had written 42 entries, totaling about 5,500 words.
Okay, now the diary was found by one of your staff, Elizabeth Safley. How did she find it? Where was it?
Liz is our librarian, and she has been working for many years on a project to go through our very large book collection and determine what books will never be used here, have never been looked at, will never be looked at, and we've been sending those to the Library of Congress for disposition within the government. This has been going on for at least 10 years. And she found in our collection five or six of these diary books for different years, 47 and later. And, they were a good candidate to deaccession from our collection. But before she does deaccessions of books, she looks through it to see if there's any. Oftentimes Truman would make a little doodle in the book or a gloss or something, and she looks for that. And so she started looking through this book and came on all this handwriting.
There are probably many things to comment on that are included in the diary, but we don't have time for all of them. Let's just take one, which is getting a lot of press, and that is the comment about by Harry about his meeting with Dwight Eisenhower. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Eisenhower was just leaving his position as chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and he was accepting a position as president of Columbia University. And he came in to talk to the president about the new reorganization of the War Department into the what was called the National Military Establishment at the time with the Secretary of Defense. And by the by, they started talking about General MacArthur. And they shared the opinion that MacArthur was going to have some kind of what Truman called a Roman triumphal entry back to the United States in 1948 and become the Republican nominee for president. And so Truman said to Eisenhower, if that happens, then Truman will support you, Eisenhower, to be the presidential nominee for the Democratic Party, and that I, Truman, will become the vice presidential nominee, and we'll win. And Truman then says, I would rather be a vice president anyway, because I like the Senate and can preside over the Senate as vice president and get my family out of this great white jail, as he called it. Quite a remarkable thing for a president of the United States to say.
Absolutely. Okay. This is already available online, and if so, where can our listeners see the diary?
The diary is on our website, the Truman Library's website, which is www.trumanlibrary.org, and we have it both scanned images of the diary pages themselves, and we have a transcript online as well.
Okay, well, thank you for joining us today. You've been listening to Ray Gesselbrock of the Truman Library in Independence, Missouri. And finally, we turn to our commentary of the week. Thomas Fleming, author of a new book on President Woodrow Wilson in World War I, tells us about a fictional character whose behavior closely approximates Wilson's and whose ghost may still be haunting the White House.
Is the ghost of Philip Drew haunting George Bush? You may be surprised to learn that Philip Drew is a character in a novel, Philip Drew Administrator. The book acquired significance when its author, Colonel Edward Mandel House, became the intimate advisor to the President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson. Philip Drew tells the story of a brilliant West Point graduate who took over a wealthy, disordered nation and led it into an era of superhuman contentment by persuading the people to make him their supreme autocrat. This vision was not very different from Woodrow Wilson's view of how things worked best politically. He seldom sought or took advice from anyone except Colonel House. Historian Gary Wills has called Wilson a Presbyterian autocrat. Wilson's performance as president revealed a Drew-like readiness to resort to military solutions. In his first term, Wilson invaded Haiti, the Dominican Republic, and Mexico. In April 1917, he led Americans into the First World War, 5 months after being reelected on the slogan, "He kept us out of war." Philip Drew's autocratic style pervaded Wilson's war-making and peacemaking. When he and Colonel House finished the famous 14-point speech stating the principles the world must accept for lasting peace, House told his diary, "We got down to work at 10:30 and finished remaking the map of the world by 12:30. At the Paris Peace Conference, the Europeans mocked the 14 points and wrote a vengeful peace treaty that sowed the seeds of World War II. In the United States, liberals as well as conservatives denounced the treaty, but Wilson rejected all attempts at compromise. When the Senate rejected the treaty, a defiant Wilson declared the 1920 presidential election a great and solemn referendum on his policies. He lost in a stupendous landslide." Philip Drew's legacy remains a temptation in America's foreign policy. Too many people, both supporters and critics of President George W. Bush, seem to think that America can or should achieve instant democracy and human rights in nations such as Afghanistan and Iraq. Unless we flavor our idealism with a large dose of realism, we may find ourselves as disappointed as the Americans of World War I.
You've been listening to Thomas Fleming, author of The Illusion of Victory, America in World War I. Fleming's commentary comes to us courtesy of the History News Network. And that brings us to the end of another week of Talking History. As always, we welcome your comments on this program or suggestions for future shows, which you can send us either by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Joey Skidmore, producer. Fiona Beatty, assistant producer. To learn more about Talking History or the OAH, visit our website at oah.org. Until next week, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.